and welcome to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. I'm Lucy Fagans, and I'm the founder and editor of The Design Files. Today's episode is brought to you by The Design Files Design Awards. We are so excited to launch our very first awards program this year, which will celebrate excellence in Australian design and creativity across 12 very diverse categories. One of those categories is sustainable design, and we are very fortunate to have Abigail Forsyth, a co-founder of KeepCup, as a judge in this category. Entries for the Design Awards are open now until June the 7th, and if you're an architect, interior designer, lighting, furniture or textile designer, craft practitioner, florist or even a stylist, we would love you to enter. Please head over to tdfdesignawards.com to find out more. Abigail Forsyth is the co-founder and managing director of KeepCup, the world's first barista standard reusable coffee cup. After originally pursuing a career in law, Abigail founded KeepCup with her brother back in 2007. It's hard to believe it now, but at that time, there was very little awareness around waste and the problems with disposable packaging. It certainly wasn't a common sight back then to see anyone take a reusable coffee cup to their local cafe. Today, though, it's a different story. Millions of people around the world are KeepCup converts, which diverts billions of disposable cups from landfill every year. Over the past 10 years, KeepCup has built incredible momentum and awareness around the reuse movement. KeepCup has offices and warehouses in London and Los Angeles, but their head office is right here in Fitzroy, Melbourne, where I recently sat down with Abigail for a super inspiring chat about her background, the incredible growth of her business, and her next big challenge, advocacy and activism to ensure the world no longer needs, wants, or uses disposable coffee cups at all. I'm here in Fitzroy at the headquarters of KeepCup, which is an incredibly inspiring Australian business. And I'm here with the company's co-founder and managing director, Abigail Forsyth. Abigail, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Thanks, Lucy.
So before we get into KeepCup, I always like to hear about people's background and what they were doing before they launched the business that we know. So I'm really keen to understand a little more about what you did before KeepCup was a thing. So I think you studied law, is that right?
Yeah, I studied law. I did really well in fine art and I wanted to go to art school and mum and dad go, why would you do that? Just do law first. And then my art teacher said, if you give this up now, you won't touch it again for 30 years.
Oh, and she was right.
She's right.
Wow, I didn't realise that. Mm. Actually, I've got a similar background. I didn't do law, but similar conversations were had in my household when I was, you know, thinking what to do at uni. And that thing of, doing something sensible and, you know, having something to fall back on and all that. But you did practice law, is that right?
Yeah, I practiced for a few years and I worked with a guy who I really respected who taught me a lot. So I'm a bit sort of, I handwrote the letters for my application, sort of passionately yours. I mean,
really?
They must have just got them and thrown them in the bin, which is what I do now. But anyway, the boss I work for was a really great thinker and really detailed and, you know, really considered in his approach and sort of taught me a bit of that discipline, although it's not really my strength.
But yeah. So was that like quite a small law firm?
It was a small law firm. So often people would come with a problem where I'd be like, oh, you know, this shouldn't be a legal solution. You should try and, it would be better to negotiate this or walk away. So I guess all the time I was thinking, oh, this is not really what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. But it must have been a pretty strong foundation for what you're doing now. I guess there's so much you learn in law that could help inform a business structure and even just, you know, relationships that are so important to all business transactions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long were you doing that? And what type of law did you practice?
So it was employment, IP, interestingly, and then, contract law, so leases. Wow. So all stuff that I use now.
Wow, that is so helpful.
Yeah.
And so how many years did you do that for before you decided to make a change?
I think it was about three or four years, and then my brother Jamie was working in the UK and he kept ringing me out with new business ideas. So he's like, oh, why don't we open a veterinary supermarket? And I'm like, oh, no, I don't really, it's not me. And then he said, I've seen these stores, Pret a Manger, and they have this convenience-based food and the food's delicious. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I like people. I'm a pretty good cook. You know, it can't be that hard. Yeah, let's give that a go.
Wow. So it feels like you always then, with your brother, you always had a sort of entrepreneurial mindset, because even though you were studying law, it's like it's not every day that a lawyer decides to launch their own business.
Or a cafe. Now I'm a parent, I think, oh, mum and dad, what must you have thought?
Like- yeah, definitely, leaving law to start a cafe. And so did you sort of feel like you would always start your own business? Like, did you have that in you, do you think, always?
I would say, not consciously, but I would say so. So dad had his own business, mum's father had his own business, my uncles had their own business. So it was sort of, I'm the first generation to go to university in the family and no one had worked for a big business. So it's sort of, you didn't really know that world.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you, I guess that is, it's what you see when you're young that makes you imagine what could be possible for yourself. And I think that with my little girl, with a little three-year-old, and I mean, I'm always busy and working, but I think it's really good for especially little girls to see mum's going to work and for them to visit mum at work and to sort of understand a little bit about that, I guess, maybe. Or just to see it and to see what's possible.
Yeah.
Because it's such an abstract notion when you're a child, work, you know, what your parents are doing when they're not at home. So you left law and you started a cafe with your brother. And so what did that look like? Did you guys just think, we're just going to run this cafe? Or did you think this is going to be one of 50 cafes? Like, what were your plans at that stage?
I think Jamie was probably always the more driven one about the ambition for that. So he saw it as like, you know, many, many cafes. I was probably a bit more, and probably still am, pretty circumspect about those sort of things. And I just wanted to make great food. And, you know, the creative part of it was really appealing to me, making the food and having the brand and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we got to 6 cafes eventually.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. That's major. So where your first one was in the city?
They were all in the city and we had one at Melbourne Airport for a while.
Yeah.
But, oh, my God, it was such hard work.
Yeah.
It's such hard work.
Yeah. Hospitality is major. Yeah. And I feel like it's, oh, I don't know. I don't work in hospitality, but I have friends that do. And it just feels like a business you never can really step away from. You know, you're always, it's just open all the time.
Yeah, it's open all the time. And you think it's about food, but so much of it's about cleaning and processes and disciplines and.
Yeah. Yeah. And people as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did the idea of Keep Cup come to you?
So we're in the cafe and we were sort of one of the first cafes to bring in a branded disposable cup.
Yeah. Okay.
It was blue. We thought it was so cool. And it had like, we put fortunes on the bottom of it. Anyway, so we had this cup and then over time I just thought, this is disgusting. Like, we're buying so many of these cups. They're used for such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
They weren't recyclable.
Yeah.
There must be a better way. So Jamie and I looked around. I went down to Myer and I tried to buy like a thermos that we could just sell in the store. Like, there was no ambition really to manufacture something.
Yep.
And nothing worked. Like, they didn't fit under the group heads. They were metal. They were ugly and clunky.
Yeah.
And then we were sort of talking about it and we're like, sure, why hasn't someone done this? Like, it seems so obvious.
Yeah.
So we thought there must be a reason. Like, people just won't do it. So then in the winter of 2007, we got in these decor soup mugs. And we gave people 50 cents off if they returned and refilled, and 15% of our customers did. So, like, oh my God, like,
amazing.
There's an idea here.
Yeah. Wow. And so, when that started happening, was that sort of that instant feeling of, oh, this is an opportunity? Like, were you immediately inspired to sort of build on that?
Sort of. Well, that was 2007, and we'd launched in 2009. So we went down the design process. I was still a bit hesitant because we'd never manufactured anything before. It was a whole new world.
Yeah.
And actually, for me, the impetus came with my daughter, who was about 2 at the time, and I'd go to work and have a coffee and then she'd have a warm milk in a sippy cup. And I thought, would I give her that in a disposable cup?
Yeah.
And then I realized it was all about behavior change and mindset, and I found that really exciting. So that was sort of what drove me in the end to pursue it.
So I want to know about what you said before about not having manufactured anything before, not having a background in product design. How did you do it? Like, I'm just imagining you and your brother and you're going, we need to make a cup. How do we do that? What do you need to make a product like that?
I guess both of us probably have always had a sort of a naive confidence in our own sort of creative powers. So, but we knew we had to get a professional in to design it. So, I mean, from the initial sketch that we gave them, it didn't really alter that. I mean, it's all in the detail how it altered from there.
Yeah. And you were, and I think still are making them in Australia, or making a large portion of them in Australia, which is fantastic. And so was it just a case of literally Google, phone book, you know, doing the rounds and finding a manufacturer?
Yeah, so we went. It's the same process as employing any sort of agency. So we went around and met them and got a feel for what they were like. One of the ones we didn't use said to me, are you crazy? Like, this is a plastic cup. If you can't sell it off the prototype, don't even bother, because it's all about, like he goes, lots of people develop great products, but they can't sell them. So they just, so that was really good advice. So through Blue Bag and all the catering clients we had, I called like hundreds of companies. And, you know, went to their sustainability team, had no money. So yeah. Then got to their marketing team. And, yeah, so we ended up selling 10,000 cups off the prototype, so before we even had the product.
Oh, and that helped with that first run of product that you made. Yeah. Wow. That must have been scary, though, to be like, we're selling this thing, but we don't actually have one yet.
Wow.
That's incredible. So at that time, you're selling these cups, and obviously, and you must still have been running your cafes at the same time. Did you have grand plans for this new brand? Like, could you imagine the business that Keep Cup would become today at that time?
No, I didn't imagine it, but there were a few. I mean, I thought I'd be able to just raise the kids at home and sell them out of the garage. That was my plan, my lofty plan.
Yeah.
But the first, we did design market in Fed Square.
Oh, yeah.
And that after, someone from apartment therapy came and did a blog about the cups that they'd seen.
Yeah.
So that afternoon, we just launched the website. We got 7 sales in America.
Oh, that must have been a sort of
just wild,
inspiring moment.
Yeah. And so, we probably cost us more to ship them there than the product, but we sort of followed wherever the interest was. And I guess we still do, because we believe that the brand and people's loyalty to it and their engagement is, you know, that's what seeds it more than anything else.
Definitely. But I guess, I mean, you have spoken about this before, but the biggest challenge really was that idea of changing behavior, because it's hard to remember now, but back at that time, 2008, 2009, it really wasn't common to see anyone bringing a cup to the cafe when they were getting coffee. So how did you tackle that? Like, did you have really strategic sort of marketing around that? Like, how did you get people on board to change the behavior? Or do you feel like it was sort of it was the right moment, the groundswell was already there?
It was definitely the right moment. And there was the people who were older than us who'd seen the time before the disposable, who went, thank goodness you're doing something about this. So, but I think the main thing was people would see that it was the right thing to do. Maybe not. I don't know. I think one, we positioned ourselves right smack in the middle of the market. So we said, you don't have to be a greenie to do something sustainable. Like, we've all got to get our hands on the wheel. So I think that's been a real strength of the way we've talked about the product and the brand. Yeah. And then we've worked really hard to build good relationships with the roasters and the baristas and the cafes, because they're the ones, like, if you walk into the cafe and the barista rolls his eyes and goes, oh, what? What's this? Versus saying, oh, good on you.
Yeah.
You know, those sort of things are what create permission.
Yeah, definitely. And all credit to you, because now, you know, when you go to your local cafe, it's so common. You feel guilty if you don't take, you know, your own cup. And I think it's really become part of the culture in Melbourne anyway. I don't live in other cities. I don't know what it's like elsewhere in the world, but I feel like now it's just accepted, and all different cups and all different brands are being used, and I don't see anyone complaining behind the coffee machine. So it's, you know, you started that. It's a really inspiring thing. And so tell us what Keep Cup looks like today. So I'm here in your office now, and it's very industrious, full of people. Tell me how many staff you have and also where your offices are around the world.
So we've got an office in LA, and there's 7 people there. And we've got an office in London. There's about 25 people there. And then office here, and there's probably about 50 people in this office in Fitzroy. So we always set up with warehouse next to the office, because the products are still sort of hand-assembled. They're shipped in parts. And I think that does something to the culture as well, because if your salespeople know the person who's actually making the cup, makes a big difference to some sort of – it just comes in a box.
Yeah, totally. So around 100 staff at the moment, yeah. It's amazing. How do you – tell me about the global expansion. Like, how did that come about? Did you have a real strategy for that international growth? No?
But in London, my brother and his partner were traveling. And so we, like, that was in 2010, 11. And we're like, oh, it's going so well here in Australia. You know, just started up in London.
Just take a few in your suitcase, sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. And didn't really realize it was totally different coffee culture, totally different setup. Like, so many big chains who were, you know, always going to be last to get on board. Yeah. Nation of tea drinkers. So they had these barriers, but they did get in at sort of ground zero of the coffee movement there.
Yeah.
And then in LA, I guess we thought, we sort of went into Amazon first, and we had a few suppliers, and then we thought, we've got to have a presence here to do all the pick and pack for all the individual cups.
Yeah.
So that's been, I mean, US is a pretty difficult market, so we're sort of still.
Yeah, but it's a big market, so I guess even if you've got a tiny share of it, it's worth being there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've said before that in the early years, carrying a Keep Cup was a bit like being in a secret club.
Yeah.
And I do feel like there's some magic in that. Yeah. And so I'm interested about the challenge of going from that sort of niche offering, which has that real magic and those really passionate early adopters, to now being very mainstream and very known. And how have you tackled that, and how, what does that look like for you, that sort of transition?
That's been a big transition. So it's funny how things happen where you sort of bang, 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 bang on the door, and then the entire wall falls down in front of you, which is sort of, I mean, that was a combination of the war on waste, the latte levy in the UK. So there's been a dramatic change in the landscape.
Yeah.
And we always positioned ourselves as going up against the disposable.
Yes.
Like, we didn't consider any other competition. And now when our customers, like our business, our cafe and retail customers are choosing, they're choosing between a whole lot of other reusable cups.
Yeah.
That seems just so boring.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I don't want to just be a product in the lineup of products. I prefer the sort of more behavior change aspect. So I guess we're sort of pivoting to try and be much stronger in campaign. So we're going for single use free by 2023. That's our sort of, and we're really trying to develop links, more links to industry and government and advocacy to push for that and be much stronger, because we've got, one, we've got a platform.
Yeah.
We've got a voice, and I feel like we've got a responsibility to use it in the most powerful way we can.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So what is that? What's the goal?
Single use free.
So no more.
So people, well, you know, ideally people don't need, want, or use disposable cups within 5 years.
Amazing. I love that. If we can support that in any way, we'll get totally behind that. That would be brilliant. You mentioned about the other reusable cups on the market. There is no shortage of other reusable cups out there. How do you sort of stay ahead of the pack in terms of the product itself? And because you do have a lot of different iterations now, is that a conscious thing to keep sort of variety in your product range and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to sort of keep innovating, and some of the more recent innovations have been ones you can't see. So we've improved the seal on the lid and a few sort of things that just sneakily happen. But I think you sort of, as coffee tastes, and as we're trying to go into new markets, so looking, say, at the Asian market where they drink a lot of bubble tea, so how do we develop a product that's really suited to that, so that it becomes a, because ideally what happens with Keep Cup is that you enjoy using it more than you enjoy the disposable one. Like, that's ultimately got to be the driver.
Yeah.
Because if it's not more fun to use or more enjoyable or says more about you, then you'll just divert back to the disposable.
Totally. Yeah, I listened to a podcast about, you know, that brand Thank You.
Yeah.
And they, one of the things that was really struck me was something they said about early on, they very quickly realized it's not enough to have, you know, a cause, and that's, it needs to just be the best product that, you know, the customer needs to love using that product first and foremost. And then, you know, it's a great bonus if it's doing something great, you know, or it has a secondary sort of impact. But if it's not a great product, it's going nowhere, basically. Yeah.
And the same with even sustainability. Like, that's about to become just a precondition for being in business, like going circular, all those things, which is exciting.
Yeah. It is. And you guys were really, you know, are at the start of all of that. So you're now in 65 countries around the world. Is that still right?
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Do you, in terms of your day-to-day, because you're now the sole managing director of this company, your brother's no longer in the company, that's a huge job for you. You're managing teams across the world. What does that look like for you? Because you're also a parent. And I'm just wondering, like, I want all the tips you can give me about running a business.
So, yeah, last year sort of things came to a bit of a crisis point, and a lot of the team said, you need HR. And I was like, what even is HR? Like, I didn't even understand it. Yeah. So I got in a consultant, and they sort of helped me map out the team. So now, instead of, it was really flat, the structure, and I had so many reports and sort of, So now I've got a leadership team that sits, that we sit together. So there's a bit more structure. There's more people for other people to go to within the business, which makes it a lot easier for me to run. So now I've got 8 direct reports instead of whatever I had before, which was a bit of a mess.
Yeah. And do you travel often to those other markets, or do you, you rely on your teams there?
Well, I brought them out in February. We had a strategy week for the first time ever, and we brought the leaders out from the other hubs. So I look, in the first years, I was on planes a lot, you know, really just, I guess, being a more ambassador for the brand than internally managing the team. Team management, probably I wouldn't put it in my top five skill sets. So having having other people who can go in and, you know, like we just had our finance manager go and he's implementing processes around the world, making sure people are like, I'd be O plus at that. So,
Well, you just literally cannot do everything. Like there's such a complex business at this scale. So have you had any mentors along the way or advisors that you've turned to when building this business?
So I've got a really strong family network. So my dad is an awesome guy. Like he's just someone who can think outside the square. So I always talk to him. Yeah. And my mom is got cut through, like, what the hell are you doing? She's quite capable of saying that occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my husband works in brand and design, so he's been a real touch point for to start discussing those issues. Yeah. And then Jamie, my brother.
Yeah.
If I want to cook up a crazy idea, talk to him.
Yeah.
I've got another brother as well who's does Minor Figures oat milk.
Oh, okay. Amazing. Yeah. That sort of somewhat like feels somehow a little bit connected to what you guys do.
Yeah.
How cool. Wow. Well, that sounds like a very dynamic family. But I still feel like growing your business, even, I mean, my business is so tiny and I still feel like I need expert advice on things. Like even, I guess, financial advice, that sort of thing comes from, you know, accountants and But I guess everyone really is just making it up as they go along.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is last year I got invited to be in like a group of women who run their own business and it was a time when I was quite stressed and I was like, oh, I don't have time to do this. And then I go in the group, oh, my God, it's all the same problems, like the same issues around people and capacity and growth and like process. It's all the same and it was a real
Was it encouraging?
Yeah, it was a real comfort.
Yeah. And is that across different industries?
Yeah, like across totally different industries.
How interesting is that?
Yeah.
I think it is hard when you're sort of, when you run your own thing, you know, you don't really have peers within the business that have the challenges you have. So it's so important to find those people and to sort of share those challenges with others, especially, you know, women in business. It's weird, women in business. Like I often get asked to speak at things around women in business and small business and things like that. And it really is hard to find women that are doing, that are running businesses, big businesses at a sort of, you know, high level and doing great things. And it really, we really are sort of outnumbered. I know it seems like a cliche to say that, but when you really look at who's running businesses out there, it's not women. And I think it's so important to have those sort of groups and to sort of, you know, learn from each other and, you know, build each other up.
Yeah.
In that way.
And network with, like, you know, someone will say, I need PR. Who do you recommend? And everyone will sort of go, I've done this, that, the other. Yeah. So it's really good.
Are you still in that group?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
How often do you meet?
Monthly. Yeah. Monthly.
Oh, amazing. That sounds so cool. Well, I need to like have a podcast episode with each of the members of your group, obviously. What's one of the greatest lessons you've learned in the course of running this business?
I think the biggest lesson is that people always trying their best. So if you approach everything with that frame, then decisions become a lot easier and clearer. So if someone's not thriving in their role, then you need to change something about the process or the structure, or because they're trying their best.
Yeah.
So there's some gap that.
That's really lovely advice. I feel like I'm getting the sense that KeepCup really is a family sort of business. Like, not that I know that your brother's no longer in the business, but like that it's run in a more personal way, perhaps, than some businesses when they get to this scale, because it's not always the case. I guess when you have, I guess, ultimate control. You don't have a board. You don't have a business partner. So I think that maybe there's something nice about that, is that it's you can really make decisions yourself, and it doesn't have to be always about the bottom line. It can be human decisions.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that that's the power every business has, really.
Yeah. I know, but somehow it gets diluted sometimes, the more stakeholders there are or something.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because we've been employing people recently, and a lot of people keep saying, oh, I want to work in a business that's like doing good. And I'm like, we can't just have those. Like, everyone's like, there's a place for good everywhere.
Yeah, that's so true. And what you said before about sustainability, you know, being sort of a given, and it should be, and it shouldn't be really something we have to talk about. That's so powerful. And even the word sustainable and sustainability is really becoming such a, you know, like zone out word, because it's lost its meaning in some ways. But yeah, hopefully it will become something that is inherent in great businesses.
Yeah. Yeah. Just on that, I heard a guy from Patagonia talking, and he said that businesses can't be sustainable. Like, the most sustainable thing Patagonia could do is shut its doors. So it's about responsible business. And I think that's pretty nice, because it just makes that definition a bit broader, a bit more ethical, a bit more to do with people and community, not just.
Yeah. Do you look to businesses like that? I know Patagonia have a huge, there's a lot of respect for the way they run their business at great scale. Do you look to other businesses like that as in a sort of inspiring way?
Yeah. And B Corp, so we're in that community, and they, when you do the audit for that, they have all these things that you may or may not be doing, but it gives you ideas. Like,
yeah,
when we first did B Corp, which was in 2000 and I can't remember, the 12 or something, like, we didn't even have an employee handbook or anything. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So, you know, it's even obvious things sometimes you might have thought of.
Yeah, I'm really interested in B Corp. Can you, sorry to put you on the spot, I know it's hard to describe, but can you just describe for our listeners briefly what B Corp is?
Yeah. So B Corp was started by these guys in America who had this T-shirt brand. I think it was in the 90s, and it was all like trash talking on T-shirts that people, it was real popular in basketball. Anyway, they started this business. It was really popular. They had really great conditions for their staff. Their supply chain was schmick. They were involved in community. So they did all these great things, and then Nike bought them and just ripped all that out.
Oh, God.
And they were like, oh.
Yeah. Devastating.
Devastating.
When you built something. Yeah.
So then they thought, well, we want to enshrine. So their values were community, environment, transparency, what'd the other thing be? And, oh, I can't remember. There's one more thing that they do. And so measuring is sort of like triple bottom line in a way, but measuring your performance. But it must be how you treat your staff. So how you treat your staff, how transparent your organisation is, community and environment.
Yeah. So it's a way for businesses to sort of manage or be held accountable for more than just the bottom line, and it's sort of an accreditation. So, and it's actually quite rigorous. We've looked at it. We're so tiny that it's sort of a little tricky when you're small. But, yeah, it's really interesting, and more Australian businesses are getting on board, which is fantastic to see. But, yeah, you were definitely one of the early ones. What year did you say you were doing?
Yeah, we were there were 42 founding B Corps in Australia, and we were one of them. And I think that, because also for us, people like, are you fair trade? And we're like, no, that's not relevant to us. Are you organic? No, it's not relevant to us. So people want some sort of external standard, and this was a way to provide that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. You've remained so focused on this one product, the Keep Car, although there have been many iterations of it. There must have been opportunities over the years for you to expand potentially into other reusable products or to solve other sort of problems that you see in the way that Keep Cup solves a problem. So is that something you're looking at, or if not, why not? You should be.
I've always been keen on maintaining a pretty singular focus on disposable cups for a couple of reasons. One, because they are probably they're one of the most ubiquitous forms of disposable packaging.
Yeah.
They're very easily replaced. They're not necessary.
Yeah.
So they're problematic. They're unnecessary, as opposed to, say, maybe packaging for food, which at times is going to preserve the life of the food or stop it getting damaged.
Yeah.
So it's unnecessary. And also just the way the brand's been set up and our supply chain and the way we sell. And I feel like if you take people on the journey and they stop using disposable cups, then you start following it. Then you start thinking about other things. And I think it's really visual as well. Like I once stumbled over this whole thing, like how the cup is, and then this guy from Coca-Cola goes, brand in hand. And I was like, yes, that's
brand
what it is.
In
brand
hand.
In hand.
Oh, yeah.
So if you compare it to, say, a lunchbox or a container, which is in your bag, you walk around holding the cup.
Yeah.
So that's been part of the success of the product.
Yeah, that's hugely powerful. But I feel like I don't know you well, I just met you, but I feel like you have got, I don't know, like you're about more than just running a successful business. As a person, you want to make a difference, and you have made an enormous difference with this product. Do you have a sort of any other burning passions of things that you still want to make a difference with, or do you look to problems like, you know, there's so much, especially now culturally, with, you know, we're hearing so much about plastic bags, the war on waste mentality, water bottles. Do you look at those problems and think, I probably should invest some time thinking what we might be able to do in those other categories, or not really?
So my brother and I were in business for 17 years together, and he was very keen on other categories. So he's gone and started Beatbox. He started Returner. So he's more looking at how people use lunch containers, I guess. Yeah. And he's doing great things there. So he's got that nailed.
Yeah, he's flying that flag.
He's flying that flag. And then in terms of like water bottles, I was just like, does the world need another water bottle? That's like, so there's so hard. Many options yeah. around. We have got yeah. something in the wings, which is sort of a bit of a MacGyver product, which is coming, which you could put water in. But I think that, I don't know, for me, it's now more about advocacy and yeah. coming. I mean, it's so naive. I've been in the little Keep Cup bubble for 10 years, but now we're working with the Australian Packaging Government. We're talking to Planet Ark. They're about to launch a circular economy hub. So more being involved in this more behaviour change part of it, yeah. trying to work with Qantas about what they're doing. Their big pledge to take 1 million single-use items. Like, how can we help them with that? Like,
oh, amazing.
Like
yeah.
we know a lot about what you need to drive the behaviour change and what happens. And so yeah. we want to use that knowledge rather than
put another product out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally yeah. understand that. What are the biggest challenges Keep Cup is facing now, like over the next, say, 5 to 10 years as it continues to grow? Like, are you just sort of, do you feel like you'll just keep doing what you're doing, or are there, I guess, competitors is one thing you've already been challenged by and you'll continue to be challenged by. Is there anything else sort of that is challenging your business that you're still working through?
I guess one or the other. We've sort of touched on some of the things like becoming more campaign oriented, yet, but also like now that there's so many Keep Cups out there, like do we become part of the problem? So what happens to old Keep Cups? Can we circularise our own supply chain? Can we get them returned to us? What happens to them? Are they all getting used?
Yeah, because you don't really want to sell one person 5 Keep Cups, yeah. do you? You want yeah. everyone to just have their one.
Yeah, or yeah. have them given out at a conference where no one really wants one. And
yeah.
Yeah, so we're trying to change the way we sell in that regard, but it's a hard trade to say, oh, no, we're not going to.
Yeah, well,
you're not going to take the order when they're just going to go and buy an alternative product. So,
yeah. How do you deal with copycats? I know that there are plenty of reusable cups out there that aren't necessarily copying, but there are also many that probably look quite similar to a Keep Cup. What's been your experience with brands that copy your designs?
So we go hard after the coffees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the counterfeit cups, as opposed to competitors, the counterfeit cups look like people think they're ours and then they leak, or their plastic isn't the same, or, you know, so it just, it drives inertia around the whole movement we're trying to create.
Yeah. So you've got a real process of like just making contact immediately, like shutting that stuff down if you can.
Well, I'd give a little plug. We use a Spanish company called Red Points, and they have bots that troll the internet, and they'll take down copies
yeah, where they see
for us.
Wow,
yeah.
That's amazing. What a great find.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, we profile and feature a lot of very small designers, you know, designers of single person businesses and things, and copying is a huge challenge for them. And
heartbreak.
The smaller you are, the harder it is to tackle that stuff. Yeah, it's rife. And I think, I mean, it also speaks to the problems, you know, so many problems in retail and fashion, and just the pace at which product
yes.
needs to be made, that it sort of isn't possible to do that without, I don't know, just churning things out without proper product development, really.
Yeah. I mean, and that's something that has been an issue for us, resisting that retail urge. Like, what's, you know, every time you go and see a retailer, what's new? It's like, well, it's nothing new. We're just still in the same problem.
Yeah.
It still exists.
The pace is crazy, though. I really feel that. Like, I think it's Instagram culture and everything is contributing to it. It's just the pace of the number of product you have to make. You need new product all the time, so you've got something to talk about from a marketing point of view, and you know, social media, you know, you always need just to be talking about yourself all the time, and it's sort of exhausting. So beyond the challenges that Keep Cup is facing, what do you see as the biggest challenges that Australia is facing more generally when it comes to sustainability and waste? Because I think we sort of do seem to be on a much better path now than we were 10 years ago in terms of people's individual accountability and awareness. But do you see that there's still really big challenges that I guess it's that legislation and things happening at that level that need to change?
I think there's huge changes need to take place. So first, there needs to be more direction from government of where we're headed and why we're headed there, and a bit more aspirational leadership about what we want Australia to look like in the future. I think there's more product stewardship. An extended producer responsibility needs to come in. So if you make a product, then you're responsible for returning it and getting it done.
A life cycle, yeah.
Yeah, a life cycle. Harmonising labelling laws is another big thing. So what's recyclable in one state is differs, and the way they label it differs. That needs to all be the same. And then I think supporting local manufacturing. So we've been working with the same manufacturer for 10 years. The guy who runs the factory is 78. And it's real. He's found the biggest problem for our speed of development has been him finding staff. All the toolmakers are now in their late 50s. So how do we? And if you're going to have a circular economy, you really need to be able to push product back into the local life cycle. Yeah. You can't be sending it to China to be processed.
Totally. I mean, that's a challenge now as well with, you know, recycling. I'm not an expert on recycling at all, but like now that China's not taking rubbish from places like Australia, and there's just so much plastic that needs to be recycled and you can't send it to China, it's sort of like a wake-up call for Australia to be like, well, if we're not making stuff here with, you know, if we don't have a manufacturing industry here, then we can't actually deal with our own waste and recycle anything. Yeah, it's challenging, hopefully.
And then when you think of like, I mean, there's just so many easy wins that I just don't understand how they're not. Like, we've got CUB here in Canada. So in Canada, they return and wash all the beer bottles. So most beer bottles are used 15 times before they're crushed. Like, Australia's got a massive problem with glass.
Yeah.
We just don't have anywhere to put it because there's so few glass manufacturers. So, yeah. But there's so many opportunities. Like, why aren't we washing our wine bottles and refilling and...
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I don't know. Why is it? We're a smallish population and I don't know, maybe things don't make sense financially. And so I don't know. But yeah, you're right.
But you've got to take the leap. Like you've got to take the leap to create it and go, this is the right thing. At some point you've got to go, this is the right thing to do.
Yep, totally. What's something you haven't done yet that you would love to do? And either professionally or personally. Do you have like a bucket list of something that you want to do?
Sorry.
No.
We've been talking about the kids all want to see the Northern Lights.
Oh, amazing. Wow, that sounds incredible. You should definitely put that on the list. And so you did briefly mention it before, but if you were going to make a sort of statement about the end game for Keep Cup, what is the ultimate outcome of all of this, do you think, of this business? Like what would be, you know, I always think, imagine being 80 and being like, you know, reviewing your life and thinking, I did pretty good on this or that. Like what do you think is, would you hope is the outcome of this business?
The ultimate outcome would be having been a part of developing the circular economy in Australia.
Yeah.
A small role, but a role in that.
Yeah. That is such a brilliant, brilliant proposition. And I've no doubt you'll achieve that. And we can't wait to be supporting that and to see the next sort of phase of that in Australia. So thank you so much. I do have 10 quick questions. This is rapid fire questions for you. What time do you set your alarm in the morning?
Unfortunately, 6:10, but I'm really better after 7:30.
Me too. What do you eat for breakfast?
Nothing.
Me neither. What's your greatest indulgence?
Salt and vinegar chips.
Yeah. What's the most visited website on your computer this week?
Local high schools.
Oh, yes. Important point. What was the last thing you bought online?
I bought, and I shouldn't really have bought them, but I was really interested in the business, toothpaste, you know, capsule things. So instead of using the tube, they're little pills.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite a cool brand. So they're coming from America, but I want to see
them. Test them out.
Test the brand experience of it. I mean, I know you can make it yourself, but I thought the kids would be more.
Toothpaste capsules. I like the sound of what? Do you know what the brand is?
Bites or something about bites or.
Okay, I'm going to look that up. I'll try and link to that if I can find that. Yeah. What is one of your weekly rituals or something you do every week?
How long do I have to have been doing it for?
Just 2 weeks.
I've recently started yoga with my daughter who's 14, and the last time I was good at yoga, I was pregnant with her, so 14
Whoa,
years.
That's the closed loop cycle, whatever you want to call it right there. Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so you're going to be doing yoga weekly with your daughter.
Yeah.
I love that. What's your favourite neighbourhood in Melbourne?
Fitzroy North.
Yeah, me too. How do you wind down? Like when you're like, how do you relax outside of work?
Last year we bought a holiday house.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I'd always poo-pooed holiday houses. I was like, what a waste. Like you just got to go and visit them, da 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 da.
Yeah.
Ranted and raved, probably deprived my brothers of having a holiday house in our childhood because I was so opinionated.
Yeah.
But anyway, when we drive down there now, I can just feel the sort of tension just just as we drive in the driveway. So
Where is your house?
Down the peninsula.
Beautiful. That's definitely like dream, long-term dream for me, hopefully. It's 9 p.m. on a weeknight. What are you doing?
Something I ban my children from doing. I'm triple screening probably. I've got the telly on. I've got the laptop on. I'm looking at my phone.
Oh, my God. You and I are very similar. And finally, if you could name just one thing you're proud of, one of your proudest professional achievements, what would it be?
I just probably my proudest professional achievement is staying the course, like keeping my hands on the wheel after all these years.
Yeah.
Because it's been tempting to take my hands off many times or feeling like I can't do it.
Yeah, definitely. That's really, I didn't expect you to say that. It's a really powerful thing to say. Yeah, I can feel that sometimes in my business too.
Yeah.
It's one thing to start something, but it's another thing to have the longevity and to still be here 10, 20 years later. So it's inspiring. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us, Abigail. It's been such an inspiring chat, and we'd love to continue supporting what you do, especially in the advocacy space around reusables. And thanks for everything you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much, Lucy. It was a great conversation.
You can find more about Abigail and Keep Cup on their website, which is keepcup.com. And you can also follow them on Instagram at Keep Cup. Free in our small business column, in which Abigail generously shared some of her wisdom in seeking external consultants for your business. You can revisit that story via the link in our show notes. And as I mentioned earlier, Abigail is one of 31 esteemed judges in the Design Files Design Awards. There's $30,000 in prize money up for grabs. So if you're an architect, designer, or creative of any kind, we would love you to enter. Please check out tdfdesignawards.com for more info. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. All the links mentioned in today's episode can be found in our show notes at thedesignfiles.net/podcast. Please also do check out our main website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to TDF Talks on iTunes. Thanks for listening.